Are we on? I always hate to be the one. Okay, that sounds right. Hi.
Hi.
We did already say hi. I just like to say it again. Our catechism, question 51. I will read the question. We will read the answer together. Question, what is the first commandment? The first commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Exodus 20, verse 3. Good to know the first. Ultimately, the task is to not just to know the first or the second through the 10th commandments, but to know the great commandment, which is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And ultimately, the 10 commandments lead to that one great commandment. So if this is a process of reading through the 10, it's a good catechism question. Today, for those of you who I'm looking at, I think I'm seeing faces, some of them for the very first time ever. Hi, my name is John Shipp. I'm guest teacher here, but I have been sort of like an adopted brother, my wife and I, and we're glad to be here again with you this morning. Happy New Year. We didn't get to see you last week, so this is our first chance to see you in 2017. I have this idea of progress in my mind. Who saw Interstellar? Okay, good. A beautiful film. I can't not watch it when it's on, you know, TV and there's a part of it. I just keep going straight to it because it gives me so much to think about. And there's this concept that is sort of the kicking point for where I want to begin today. John Lithgow plays the father of the central character, the father-in-law of the central character. And he says something about halfway through the film. And this is when you realize that he's referring to the time in which we live from a future in which things are no longer as they are on this planet. And that a terrible famine has come upon the earth and decimated the population of the world. And his way of summing up this time was something like this. He says, you know, when I was a kid, they were inventing something new every day. And it was like Christmas all the time. Think of it, 6 billion people and every last one of them wanting it all. And the first time I watched the movie, I thought, what is he talking about? Think of it, that's 6 billion people, that's right now. But then I had not realized that this was in a distant point in time. The population of the earth was dying out. And what they really needed was food. And the crops were failing at a sequential rate. And it didn't really say in the movie that the earth's population is down to 1 billion or less than that. But the idea was that really the only thing that could grow at that point in time was corn. And blight was succeeding in every part of the world. So they say goodbye to okra. And some people say, goodbye, okra. Never come back. But no, if you need food, you'll eat even okra, right? Especially the fried okra at Lucille's, which they have taken off the menu, I hate to report. So that's bad news. But if we go and we protest, they'll bring it back, right? Okay, thanks. Join me with that. So we don't need technological advances in such a society. We need agricultural advances. What's the meaning of progress? Is it faster cell service? Is it a faster bullet train? Is it a better economy? Is it higher education? Is it supreme medical attention? Is it longevity of life? What's the definition of progress? We have our own definition of progress. We keep thinking we just need to make things better. So we keep revising all of our current equipment. We're trying to make things faster and smarter and better and maybe even longer lasting. And I got this story. I don't bring a lot of news to this congregation from the nation of China, but there was a story this week about the escalators in China. over the past few years, the movement has been to try and create a stand right or walk left, stand right movement on the escalators in public places so that people who are walking in a hurry can get along faster just by staying on the left. So people have been encouraged, you know, move over to the right and let people go through. What this has done, though, is it's caused an uneven wear on the escalators. So they're wearing down and creating a public health crisis as escalators are breaking down. You think, well, that can't really be a problem. But in the first half of 2016 alone, there were 22 escalator, elevator, and moving sidewalk accidents in China, resulting in the deaths of 56 people and injuring hundreds of others. So yeah, it's a crisis. The people who are making the escalators are saying they weren't meant to be used that way. They were meant to be worn, you know, evenly with the weight balanced on every stair. They weren't meant to be walked on. Have we gotten to the point where even our moving sidewalks and our escalators aren't technologically advanced enough for us? We have to have them so that we can walk as fast as we can along. Are we in that big a hurry, is what I'm asking. That we can't just ride the escalator. That we can't just ride the moving sidewalk. I don't know. I think if all we're interested in is getting faster, better, stronger, smarter, better all the time, that's not gonna necessarily be the definition of progress. In fact, from God's perspective, and only God's perspective, sometimes the definition of progress is only measured by redemption. Redemption is the central theme of the Bible. In fact, I've heard even one Hollywood producer say that the redemption of man is the only story, and that there are variations of that. So when I watch a movie, when I'm watching a television show, when I'm even listening to a radio program, I'm listening for the redemption of man. I want to see the redemption factor taking place in any story that is told to me or that I tell. So we look to the Bible and there are redemption stories everywhere. But the progress of loss is something God specializes in. And it says that even when we fall back, God can move us forward. God can pick us up. Even when we are lost, God can find us. When we are sick, when we are broken, God can heal us and mend us. That's His version of progress. Let's take a look. It's in Luke chapter 15. We're going to read something that's supremely familiar. Unless you're going to get a chance to experience it for yourself for the very first time ever, in which case I say you're blessed to hear this parable that Jesus tells. In Luke chapter 15, beginning right with chapter in verse 1, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" Verse 3, "Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. And then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, 'Rejoice with me, I've found my lost sheep.' I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent." We'll continue. Verse 8 tells another story. "Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends," bless you, "and neighbors together and says, 'Rejoice with me, I found my lost coin.' In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." So lost and found, a common theme all through the Bible, all through the teachings of Jesus. We read one in the opening scripture, in the congregational scripture, about buying a field that has a treasure in it, or being on the lookout for a pearl of great price. God is a God who is searching. He's looking for us. He's looking for his whole body. He's looking for his whole bride. The whole kingdom is built on this search of God. A key verse for me in the Bible is in 2 Chronicles chapter 16. Verse 9 is right in the middle of a heated discussion. If you read before it and you read after it, you wouldn't know that it was there, this nugget, this beautiful truth. But it says in 2 Chronicles 16, 9, the eyes of the Lord search to and fro throughout the world, seeking those whose hearts are his completely, that he may strengthen them. That means he's looking for a purpose. He's not just gathering all the stuff that he's lost and wants to find again so that he can have them in his little collection. There's a purpose behind everything that God's doing. When he's seeking those whose hearts are committed to him fully to strengthen them. But he's also seeking the lost so that they can be brought back into his family, back into the protection of living in the camp under God's shield of faith. He wants to armor us so that we're not defenseless. He wants to build us up so that our lives have consequence, so that we have a sense of our value and our meaning. But he also just doesn't want us out in the wilderness where we become food for predators. That one sheep is on a death sentence until the shepherd finds it again. So he goes. Now, I've never had to pick up a sheep and put it over my arm and carry it. Have you? Anybody carried a sheep over your shoulders that way? No? Okay. My dog broke a toe in the park chasing a rabbit one time, and I tried to carry him the normal way. I keep having dog stories, but they work, right? So at the time, he probably weighed about 70, 80 pounds, and I carried him as far as I could, and I'm like, I can't carry the dog back to the car. And he couldn't walk. He literally tried, but he just couldn't do it. So I thought, wait, Jesus carried sheep over his shoulders. So I got underneath him and I put him on my shoulders. He's looking at me like, nah. Really? And my son was with me too. He's like, are we doing this? I'm like, yeah. So it worked. That's the way to bring a hurt animal back to camp. They can't walk on their own, or they're lost and they're straying, and so you bring them back in. I've even been told this: if the sheep won't come, the shepherd will break the sheep's leg to make the sheep dependent on the shepherd again. So your song is prophetical. Your song choices today were prophetical. So we rely on you. We need to rely on God. And we can't do it when we're feeling so self-sufficient. Like, what'd you come get me for? I was doing fine. No, you weren't. You were about to be eaten by wolves and you didn't know it. I saved your life. No, you didn't. I was fine. No, you didn't. I'm coming to save you. I'm not coming back. Well, I'm going to break your leg. Now, this isn't a picture of Jesus coming around whacking you on the shin to break your leg and bring you home. But it is saying that if you have prayed the prayer, God, save me. God, bless my life. God, use me in your kingdom, and you're rebellious and off on your own, he may say, let me cripple you a little bit and make you need me again. Not a hateful thing, a beautiful thing for a shepherd who loves his sheep and is rejoicing over the one that he found instead of the 99 who stayed put. Now, you may be thinking to yourselves, aren't we the 99? We're here at church on Sunday morning. So what's the message for us? Well, we'll get to it. But there's also this coin. And you think to yourself, okay, woman has 10 coins, she loses one, she goes through this whole process of finding it. But let me just put it to you this way. If you lost a tenth of your net worth in one day, think of that. Hold on. It's okay. You didn't lose it. But just think if you did. If you lost a tenth of your net worth in one day, wouldn't you do everything you could to recover it? And if you did, by some stroke of luck, get your net wealth back, a tenth of your net wealth back in one day, you would have a celebratory dinner that night, would you not? Calling up your friends, hey, I almost lost big on the market, but I rebounded and I came back. We're having dinner. Steak's on me. So her problem is solved first by turning on the light and cleaning things out and finding the things that she seeks, finding the one thing that she seeks and rejoicing over it like a lost sinner. So God is comparing himself to not the sheep, but the shepherd, and not the coin, but the woman. And he's going to go a little further, because here we have something you possess and something else you possess. You've got a living animal. We have responsibility for living animals. And the other is just money. We have responsibility and stewardship over money, too, but we feel bad when we lose money, and we feel bad when we lose animals. You ever have a dog run away? Anybody lose a cat? Or your turtle abandon your backyard? Or okay, lost turtle. That's bad. No lost cats, no lost dogs. Oh my gosh, my little schnauzer Anchor ran away from my family. Our last name is Ship. We had a dog named Anchor. How about that? He ran away. Like, what other family is he going to be so suitably named in? But we never saw him again. And as a kid, I remember thinking, that's terrible. And I even would wonder from time to time, like, how long do dogs live? Would he still be alive? I was thinking 5 years later, I hope he's okay. We moved to another city. Man, I hope somebody's taking care of him. I hope he's not looking for us. That's just my kid's heart thinking about my lost dog. Imagine God looking for you. Created for constant communion with him. He's feeling it, even if you're not. That's why he's the one looking. That's why people matter to God more than coins or cattle. Verse 11, the lost son. Jesus continued, we're in Luke 15, verse 11. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. And not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And stop for a second. That could be somebody's epitaph. Right there on the tombstone. Squandered his wealth in wild living. In fact, it is the epitaph of many people. They had it, they lost it, and never got it back. And that's the end. And God's not content with that being the story for any one of us. Had it, lost it, never got it back, is unacceptable for God. Now, he is not going to presume to impose his will on any of us and say, you know, you're really, really lost. I'm demanding that you come back with me. But he will make certain circumstances so bad that we'll at least try to consider it. And that's why we have this story. This thing that this child asks, in Jewish culture and in lots of cultures, this is unheard of. The children don't go to their living parents and ask them for their inheritance. The inheritance is after your parents die. You don't ask them for it while they're still alive. To do that is to basically say, I wish you were dead. Give me my money. But the father does it. Doesn't even say he argued about it. He just went ahead and divided the inheritance between the sons. Let the younger one have his. And off he goes to a distant country to squander his wealth in wild living. In verse 14, it says, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And when he came to his senses, and it doesn't say how much time has gone by. Do you have a picture? How long does it take you to spend your inheritance in wild living? Probably not very long. Maybe months? I mean, maybe if he's like carefully parceling out his wild living, but wild living is wild living. It's just go for broke. Eat, drink, and be merry. Making friends, spending like crazy, and then it's gone. And now there's a poverty, and your best job option is feeding pigs. And the pigs are eating better than you are. That's telling you something, right? We're in the middle of verse 17. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here am I starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went off to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." Verse 21, the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. This is a good story. What's necessary for this story to take place is a state of mind that comes upon you when you realize that you have bottomed out. I don't know how many of you in this life, in this room, have had the chance to feel your life scraping the bottom of the barrel. But I have, and it's a terrible feeling. It's gnawing in your stomach, not just from hunger. It's literally the choices that you've made eating you up, realizing that you have made decisions that have cost you fellowship with your family and fellowship with your friends and the inability to even traffic in life. People who are bottoming out have trouble keeping a job, have trouble getting anyone to believe them, because they're pretty good at telling lies most of the time. Bottoming out is when you'll consider taking out a loan with a loan shark. Drastic things. People get into criminal activities when their life starts bottoming out. They consider things that previously were inconceivable to them. Your life bottoming out is the place where you can't even imagine that it's you that it's happening to. You've heard of horror stories like this, and you even told yourself, "I'll never let that happen to me." Fact. That's why I'm going to ask my dad for my inheritance, because I'm going to take care of that ahead of time. Watch. I'm going to go make my mark in the world, and you see how well I do. I am never going to bottom out. And I hope I'm looking into the faces of people who have never bottomed out and will never bottom out. There'll still be a spiritual low point for you somewhere. But this young man woke up in a pigsty and realized his servants, his father's servants, were eating better than he was. And he made a really important distinction between his previous position in his family with his father and the concept of a future position in his family with his father. He realized, "I have forfeited my previous place." Why? Because he's already collected his inheritance. You couldn't go back and say, "Hey, I used it all. I need another inheritance." That doesn't happen. You only get one. So if you've used that inheritance, there's no way for you to go back and say, "You know, I really did badly with it, and I kind of made some mistakes, and if you give me another shot, I'll do better." That's not going to happen. So wisely, this son realizes, "My only shot is to go back in complete humility." And there's a desire for him to go back too. I think there's a sense of appreciation now. Maybe when he was living with his dad, he didn't think it was so great. Maybe he thought, plenty of other people live better than I do. Maybe that's why he went to a distant country. Maybe he'd heard rumors. You know, across the border, everybody's living it up. You don't have to stay here in this little town with all these small town people. And he did it, Peter Gabriel. He says, I'm going to go big time. I love the fact that the song Big Time starts with all small words. The place where I come from is a small town. They think so small, they use small words. But not me. All small words, bro. Where's your big words? If you're going big time, let's hear them. I'm smarter than that, he says. And off he goes with his dad's inheritance and squanders it all on wild living and is this close to having it etched on his tombstone and realizes, I gotta go home. But I'm not gonna be able to go home as my son, as my dad's son. I'm gonna have to go back as a servant. That's all there is to it. I hope he takes me back. I'll be better off that way. And maybe he knows that deep inside his father is a compassionate man. But he's really only going back thinking, man, if I could just get a job working for my dad, that's all I need. That will be enough for me. That's called contrite of heart. Contrition. This is an honest appraisal of yourself. When you don't think more of yourself than you ought, and you're willing to look at others as higher than you. In his case, his father's workers. He doesn't think so highly of himself that he couldn't go to work for his father, but he doesn't think so lowly of his father's workers that he wouldn't be willing to join their ranks. Something's happened to him, and it's a good thing. It's the equivalent of his leg being broken and being brought back by the shepherd. Even though his dad didn't go searching for him, it says that his father was scanning the horizon, waiting for any sign of his son to return. He wanted him to come back. I would want my son to come back. My father would have wanted me to come back. Are you scanning the horizon for the lost to return? Who do you know that's in the worst spiritual trouble? Friend of yours, or a cousin, or a sibling, or a coworker, and you're not their father or their mother, but God has you in their life for a specific purpose. Because everybody's got to have somebody praying for them, right? I mean, that's what grandmothers are for. Grandmothers cover as many people as they can with their prayers, and thank God for grandmas. I thank God for both of my grandmothers. They were praying women, and I don't know how many prayers they prayed for me, but I'm grateful for every one of them because I needed every one of them. And I needed someone scanning the horizon for my return so that when I came back, I could be welcomed in. And I didn't need to be welcomed in as a full-fledged heir any longer. I've squandered that. I just need someplace to come home to, someplace nice to put my head down. His father must have had nice stables because he's thinking, man, that would be so much better than this pigsty. I'm feeding pigs. They wouldn't even let me eat the pig food, and I would eat the pig food. What am I going to do? No prospects, no future. I got to go home. And he goes home and he says exactly the thing that he said to his father that he had in mind to say. Not as your son, but as your servant, I'm asking for permission to come back. Now, some of us, we like to play those odds. We think to ourselves, I'm going to go back and beg for mercy. And then we find out, hey, they're happy to see me. I'm not going to beg for mercy. They're ready to see me. Let's have a party. No. That's real contrition of heart, when you keep that same attitude of spirit and just say what you know you are. The reason that brought you back, that's still your reason. I'm not here as a son. I'm here as a slave. I'm here to work. That's all I need. And his father supplied all the rest. All the joy came from the Father, who was so happy. Like that woman who had turned on the light and swept the house and found the coin and rejoiced and threw a party. Like the person who found treasure in a field and was elated and hid it again and went, sold everything they had to buy this field because there's treasure in it and its value. The Father had fixed a value on the life of the Son, and it was inestimable. It was higher than the Son even believed. In fact, it was so high that it bothered the other son. Let's read his story. Verse 25, meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and he came near the house. He heard music and dancing. Well, so they started the party without him. That might be part of his disdain. Verse 26, so he called one of the servants and asked him, what was going on? Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. Verse 28, the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. Verse 31, my son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. There's a danger in church when we're safe and sound and kind of looking outside, particularly at those who have left. And sometimes they leave in a clash of fire, you know, saying, bye, y'all, had it with you, you'll never see my face again. And then they come back with their tail between their legs. We could be a little on the disgusted side. Could be a little bit on the disdainful side. Could be a little bit on the resentful side at this idea that somebody could go out and live like hell for a few years, squander a good portion of the family's resources, and just come home and have a celebration for them. We're in danger of that. If you're doing fine in your walk and you hold tight to God, things are okay between you and the Lord. You're walking in the light as He is in the light, and you're continuing to walk with Jesus as you did on the day that you were saved. And somebody else seemingly gets away with murder, comes back, is forgiven, and brought back into place of fellowship with God. And we sit around thinking, well, that's just not right. I just want to caution all of us against that attitude, because it's not like they got away with murder. It's not like they had the most rewarding time spiritually living that way, squandering their wealth in wild living. Everybody I know who has lived that way and has come back to the Lord with this humble attitude generally spends a good portion of time having to spiritually deal with all the stuff that came with the rebellion, that came with the prodigal time, bad habits they learned, that feeling of having missed out and trying to just make up for lost time with God, and a sense of shame and a sense of I'll never be able to make it up to God when they don't know that's not what God's asking. So you don't want to trade places with those people, do you? Like the people in the lifeboats looking longingly at those on the deck chairs of the Titanic, right? I don't want to trade places with someone who's gone off binging on a wild life. But I also, if they come back to God and are saved, shouldn't I be rejoicing? You say, well, maybe just so-and-so, maybe just the normal guy, but not my brother who gave me a bad attitude, not my sister who put it in my face, or not the other family member who I feel has betrayed us and brought shame on my family, or infamy, or has a criminal past now. That's harder to do, isn't it? And that's why the father's dealing with this son this way. We're possibly in more danger being this kind of person than we are by being the prodigal who hasn't yet realized I need to humble myself in the sight of the Lord and let him lift me up. Both lessons need to be taught. And both have to do with this concept of progress. How much progress are you going to make in this year? What do you hope your life will be like by the time we get around to December 2017 and we are so ready to flip the page and get on with 2018? Because that seems like that's a pretty good pattern for most years. Had about enough for this year, getting ready for the next one. But if you have this thought in your mind that you'd really like to grow in 2017, grow spiritually, and be more dependable than you were previously. This is how the concept burrowed its way into my brain. Someone challenged me, John, really, what do you want to be like in 5 years? What do you want to be different? And I could actually think of some things that I didn't want to be the same about my life in 5 years. And it was safe to think of it in 5 years because that's so far away, we might not even get there. The rapture might come before that happens. So I can visualize my life at its peak in 5 years. What would that be like? What kinds of things will I no longer do? What kind of things will have left my ways? What kind of new things will I have adopted? And ultimately, you kind of come up with this picture of a version of you that's just more mature than you are, right? A little more grown up. Maybe you make more money because you're at your job. You have been proven responsible and given a little more of a pay increase that comes with being responsible. Maybe your friends will think of you as the most steadfast person that they know. They can totally depend on you. Maybe you'll have better friends. Maybe if you're not married, you will have met someone who thinks you're the best thing that ever happened to them. That'd be awesome. Maybe if you're married, the one that you're with will think, ah, what a great decision I made. I'm so glad I married this person. That'd be a great 5-year plan, would it not? And so then the thought was, why wait 5 years? Go now. And I didn't say that, and neither did the person who has asked the picture of 5 years. I felt like it was God saying, that's a great vision for your life. Why don't you go right now? Why wait 5 years to become the person that you dream of being? Start now. If in that course of 5 years you were thinking of breaking some bad habits, let them go. If during the course of that 5 years you were thinking of starting some excellent habits, start them now. There's nothing stopping you, is there? Really? If you want to have better friends by being a better friend, go for it. Do it now. Don't wait 5 years. Don't wait 10 years to become the person that you see yourself as in 10 years. Start now. You could do it. Now, full disclosure, I have trouble doing it myself. I have challenged myself to jump, make that quantum leap. Yes, I'm going to go straight forward, but I also have thought, you know what? There were things that I just thought were impossible. That was the only reason stopping me from dropping bad habits. I just didn't think it was possible. And I find out, like, it's so easy sometimes to stop a bad habit. It's so easy to start a good habit. Sometimes starting a good habit is just by sticking with it for And I give you this formulaic gaze, but I'm going to give you an example of how to start a good habit and why. McCabe's Guitar Shop, down here on Pico, on their website, tells you if you're going to buy a new guitar and start playing guitar, you have to stick with it for 60 days. Stick with it for 60 days. Maybe I just touched on your progress for 2017. You're thinking, by the end of 2017, I would love to be able to play at least my favorite worship song. You can do this. And here's why they say, and it's right on their website, which I thought was so beautiful. It says, you can teach your hand the shape of the chord, the D chord, right there. There's your G, there's your C, your E minor, your A minor, your D. For me, it's all hand muscle memory. It's there. You can do it. You can teach yourself those shapes. You can look them up. You can learn them. You can show your fingers where to go and when to strum and have the basics of it down. It's in here and it's in here. But there's something physiologically taking place between here and here. It's in the neural part of your body. It's in your nerve endings. You're creating new neural paths that are growing to solidify. So it's not just the memory of learning the chord. It's the whole musculature that goes with it, and it grows at the same rate that your hair and your fingernails grow. 60 days. You need it for the physiological part of learning how to play guitar. 60 days. And a good habit also takes root in spiritual ways that I can't describe. But if the physiological part is enough for you to go on, go for it. If you've never practiced the spiritual discipline of fasting, and you say to yourself, man, I'd like that to be part of my life, find out. What is fasting all about? If you've thought to yourself, my prayers seem aimless, ask the Lord. Ask wise people. Ask the people you respect the most. What is missing from my prayer life? What can make my life with God more intimate? There are ways you can find out and gain the spiritual disciplines and the spiritual strength that you might be seeking. But let me look at it to you this way. In the words of someone that I deeply respect, C.S. Lewis, he measured progress this way. And it's really kind of the heart of what we see in the prodigal son's story. It says, we all want progress. This is C.S. Lewis. But progress means getting nearer to the place you want to be. And if you have taken the wrong turn, to go forward does not get you any nearer. If you are on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man. That means in the story of the prodigal son, the brother who went away with the inheritance and turned around and came back was more progressive than the son who stayed, according to C.S. Lewis's appraisal here. He says, there's nothing progressive about being pig-headed and refusing to admit a mistake. And maybe that's what we need to change the most this year. I will go on record and say, I would really like to not be as pig-headed as I have been and admit when I have made a mistake. And I'll say it to my wife first, who knows how pig-headed I can be, and who knows that I sometimes don't like to admit when I've made a mistake, though I make plenty of them, and I should own up to them more often. We can all get someplace by starting right there. Not being pig-headed. When you've made a mistake, it's not such a big deal to let people know, I blew it, I'm sorry, I'm responsible. Seek forgiveness. God is amazing at giving forgiveness. He loves, He gives, He forgives. That's His character. It's right in the heart of the Father in this story. In fact, if you've ever wanted to know, what is the character of God the Father like? This is it. This is what He wants to do. This is what He's committed to doing, and this is what He is faithful to do at all times. We have an opportunity to take part in God's definition of progress, because It's constantly taking place, this loss. The progress of loss is God's. I'm going to end this by just showing you a few places in the Bible where the word found is specifically significant to God. Genesis 7:1. Then the Lord said to Noah, "Go into the ark, you and your whole family, because I have found you righteous in this generation." God was looking for and found someone righteous in Noah's generation. Isaac took Rebekah into the tent of his mother Sarah. He married Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac found comfort after his mother's death. God supplies comfort to those who are seeking his comfort. In Genesis 39, Joseph found favor in Potiphar's eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. Found faithful. Found favor in someone's eyes. Did you know that you can find favor in God's eyes? Where there is strife, there is pride, but wisdom is found in those who take advice. And this one. When Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly." Jesus said to him, "Shall I come and heal him?" The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. And I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." And when Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, "Truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith." The eyes of the Lord range to and fro throughout the world, seeking those whose hearts are his completely, that he may strengthen them. Will he find favor and faithfulness in your eyes so that you can find favor and faithfulness in his eyes? Lord, we just thank you for blessing our lives the way you do. Thank you that when we were lost, you were committed to seeking for us. And you're still seeking. The lost are almost without number. There are millions living directly around all of us right now who have never said yes to the offer of forgiveness from Jesus Christ and are carrying all that weight themselves. God, help us to just share the good news that they can be forgiven with them. Wherever we have the opportunity, Lord, allow us to help those people get that weight off of their backs and to walk in freedom with the living God. Lord, we've also just experienced what it feels like maybe to be jealous of somebody who maybe got undeserved favor. It went off the rails and committed terrible acts, and everyone knows it, and yet they received forgiveness. They received restoration. They received redemption and salvation. God, may we be the kind of brother and sister who'd just be ready, like the Father, watching and waiting for those who are coming home. The lost sheep, the lost coin, the pearl of great price. Lord, this is the kingdom. May we take part in the joy of the lost and found that is the joy of your heart. We commit this to you in Jesus' name. Amen.